This is exactly right.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you leaving? Are you on your way back home? Either way, we want to be there. Doesn't matter how much baggage you claim. Give us a time and date, terminal and gate. We want to send you off in style. We want to welcome you back home. Tell us all about it. Were you scared or was it fine?
Mouth horn.
Do you need a ride? 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 Do you need a ride?
With Karen and Chris.
Welcome to Do You Need a Ride? This is Chris Fairbanks.
And this is Karen Kilgariff.
Hello, Karen.
Oh, hello, Chris.
I did a taping for a commercial today, and I had to do it a second time in Spanish, and I'm just letting you know I am bilingual. It took me 4 hours though. I had to listen to it. I had to dictate it, translate it because it wasn't provided, oddly. So I had to translate the English, and it felt so weird doing the accent. Like I learned it in college, but it felt very strange. To do a Spanish accent. Am I weird for
our French teacher in high school used to get mad at us all the time because she would be like, répondez, s'il vous plaît. And she'd be saying shit like that. And we'd always be like, whatever. Je m'appelle Karen. Like, we would not do French accents. We all refused to even, especially not like, do the R thing or the throat thing, but just like we would all keep our California accents while we were doing it.
I guess it felt like I was doing an accent. Like when I do the reggae stuff, it seemed like I was comedically, it seemed like someone would be offended if they walked in while I was doing it. But I'm speaking Spanish though. It was so, because it would go back, it was for the California lottery. So as soon as it got to that, I'd go California lottery and then I'd drop the accent. I don't know. It was very strange.
Let's hear it. Just give us a sampling.
Oh, God, I didn't memorize it. Okay, wait, I will. Here we go. And we are on in
5, 4, 3, 2.
And I wasn't ready. Here we go. And
I'm going to count you back in. You don't do the last two numbers. In 5, 4, 3.
¿Por qué siente también reventar burbujas de plástico? Por la misma razón que jugamos Scratchers de California Lottery. Ponelo un poco de juego a tu día. Tu día. Tu día. Oh, I hope I didn't do it like that on the recording. I think I said du tía, which means something about your aunt.
Oh, no. You're supposed to be saying, are you saying today?
Today, yes, you're right.
Thank you.
I mean, are French and Spanish that similar to where you just moved?
No, I'm smart. It's a context clue. No, you know what I mean? That'd be crazy.
The reason I didn't do that well is because I didn't put on my father's glasses. I actually have trouble reading.
Oh, there they are.
There they are. Yeah. I've grown blind during this, but that's going to stick with me. Yeah, por la misma razón que jugamos Jugamos, Scratchers Day, California Lottery. That's how I was doing it, because I'm not going to have the accent to California Lottery.
No, you shouldn't. And I think that's how many people, many Californians, many native Spanish speakers,
okay,
also, because they are bilingual, that's how they do it. I always hear like the girls talking to each other where they're speaking in Spanish so that other people can't hear them.
Right.
But then they're like, da 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 da, you know, Twitter. Or they'll say a thing that's
right
American
right.
or anglicized.
Perfect. Exactly.
This is a problematic conversation. Let's introduce our guests.
It maybe is, but the reason I brought it up is I was worried that I did the lottery California line, but I didn't do the accent, so I shouldn't have even brought it up. I'm fine. I didn't do anything wrong.
I feel like that's the way I hear people do it on the radio when they're speaking Spanish, but then they say the thing in English. They do it.
In my mind, I did it problematically, but I think I did it correctly. I just had to talk through it at a strange time at the beginning of our podcast, and I hope that's okay.
Look, this is where it's the first 4 minutes of the podcast where we bring our worst problems.
Right.
And then we pull our guest into those problems and say, come and solve these for us, please.
Are you sure we shouldn't change the name of the podcast to Off on the Wrong Foot? It's got a nice ring to it.
And it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And we have a guest today, Karen.
We certainly do.
And I am holding her book. It's funny. Why am I holding it up? There's no TV cameras. But look, do you have it?
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Oh, yes. I got sent one very early because I'm friends with our guest.
Well,
IRL.
Since you're such good friends, I will let you do the honors of introducing her.
Okay, back all the way off. Ladies and gentlemen, today our guest is a multi-hyphenate. And you can tell me, Mandy, if I get the order wrong. But I would say she is a producer. She is a photographer.
Photographer.
She is a booker extraordinaire. She is a helper of artists around the world and fucked up stand-up comics who can't get their shit together. She's a facilitator of the arts. Her name is Mandy Johnson.
And a writer.
Hi, guys.
And a writer of books.
And a writer of books. A curator of books and writing. Mandy Johnson.
Mandy Johnson.
I didn't back off.
No, it's perfect.
Get
together.
Yay, Mandy. That's your official introduction.
That's so many additional multi-hyphens. I'm going to keep all of them, Karen.
Good. You should. I think for me, I know you best as the person who, when I started doing stand up again and knew it was a bad idea.
It was definitely not a bad idea.
It was not a bad idea.
Not this most recent time, but the first time when I was doing guitar comedy.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, that was great. Everyone likes it.
Thank you. But for me personally, just my personal experience was humiliation and also there was a lot of tech involved that I couldn't, there's a lot of things that were involved I couldn't handle.
Right.
And when I did Super Serious, and when I met Mandy the first time, it was just like, I got you. Here's this parking spot for, I'll meet you at the door. It was like, she knew exactly how high maintenance I was and how to get me into that show so that I wouldn't like completely cave inside before I got on stage.
Right.
And she is perfect at doing it. She gives everybody exactly what they need or don't need. It's makes all the difference in the world.
Oh, it's so sweet. We were so excited when Karen, when you came back to comedy. And I think at the time I told you that producers in the independent comedy scene in Los Angeles were like, oh my God, Karen Kilgariff is doing shows again. This is so exciting. That's truly how me and Joel felt. We're like, oh, this is so exciting. And we've always wanted to have her on. And so when you came into our show, we were so pumped. I was so excited about it. So
it felt a little bit like those dreams you have when you're in your late 30s, early 40s, where you're back in high school, but you're in your late 30s, early 40s, where you're just like, I shouldn't be here. Why am I taking this math test? Only it was my real life. That's how it felt.
Yeah, that's my reoccurring nightmare is some Billy Madison situation where I have to quit. I have to cancel all my gigs. I have to move out of my apartment. There's so much high school I missed. and I have to go back because of a class I forgot about. I didn't just go miss the test at the end. I absolutely forgot about my seventh period algebra, and I have to relearn and redo it. It's a reoccurring nightmare.
I love
and
that
you
this
tell you try to tell people. Sorry.
Oh, I was gonna say I love that this nightmare. You're in your head. You're like, I'm a successful comedian, but I still need to go back and get my high school diploma.
Better get it.
Right. Why? What exactly? I don't know. It's some honor thing. Like, I have to go do this. What I have framed and, of course, hung in my living room, this diploma prior to my college degree, is a farce. I got it. I lied. I have to go back.
I did that a lot with, I would go back to play on my old softball team, but it was, of course, all new young people. And I would keep looking at people and going, I wasn't even that good when I did it. Why am I here? And I'd be like, listen to me, I'm 42 or whatever I was at the time, where I'm just like trying to explain to the other adults at the school, like, please, I can't put this uniform on. Please don't make me do this.
Yeah, that's the same dream. What does it mean? We need a dream analyzer.
Mandy. Oh, that's the other hyphenate. Yeah, dream analyzer. Okay. Mandy.
Analyze
this. It's probably just some form of anxiety.
I think that's like all of my dreams.
Like not being good enough, not succeeding, not completing whatever you set out to complete. My reoccurring things are just versions of whatever my job is at the time that I just work. So like when I cocktailed in college, I would just dream that I cocktailed the whole night. And so I'd wake up and I wouldn't feel like I ever went to sleep. And when we were at like festivals, I would often dream of working the festival the whole night and then get up and have to do a whole other day of festivals.
Oh, that's what I can't. They're kind of realistic. Like that could possibly happen. So it's so disappointing for that to be a dream. Remember the action, the weird things, even being chased or falling. I don't dream those things anymore. They're just realistic where I'm screwing up an appointment or something.
Yeah. And in the pandemic, they've just been like versions of masked or like I'm the only masked person and everyone else isn't. Or I've forgotten my mask in some kind of very important, crazy way. And therefore, I have put everyone who lives with me at risk and like everyone I love somehow. They've just all been like weird versions of like how I'm going to somehow contract COVID and then give it to everybody I love.
Which is the most realistic. Then that day, that exact thing happens. It's just not scary because you're awake and you know how to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a dream the other night that it wasn't stressful. It wasn't anything. It was just no matter what anyone said to me in the dream, I'd go, that's okay. I just kept saying that over and over. And when I woke up, I was like, I think this was a good dream. I think this is the thing to focus on most things don't matter.
Your subconscious was correct. Everything's fine. It's going to be fine. Eventually everything will be fine.
Yes, exactly. This is very specific and we don't have to talk about dreams the whole time, but you are a dream analyzer, Mandy.
So it is how I make all of my money. So
that and the tarot cards. So I have been doing this thing where when I wake up, there is a moment I'm realizing now because I've been dreaming during this whole past year. There's a moment awake.
To clarify, did you not before?
I did not before.
Okay.
You didn't?
Very rarely. And it might have to do with the fact that I was drinking more.
Sure.
I think it does. And not so much that I just all of a sudden I'm dreaming more and it is proportionate to me not ever going out or having drinks. It's a weird, subtle way of admitting I had a problem or finding out right now in this moment.
I'm sorry. There's a lot to handle all at once, Chris.
And I haven't even gotten to the dream. This is where it gets, boring. I wake up and I keep my eyes shut, but I know I'm awake, but I'm not quite because I'm dreaming about the alarm. And I dream I convince myself in a dream state that time is a malleable thing and clocks are not as we know them. I'm not sure how I do this, but I convince myself that the clock is behind 12 hours or something. And while I sleep, I actually have this decision and I push snooze and I miss or I turn it off and then I just don't wake up. It's actually become a problem where I sleep while I'm asleep, convince myself it's not happening. I don't just sleep through an alarm. Like, people do that.
Do you ever have it where I have it sometimes where I'm aware in the dream, I'm aware that I'm dreaming. I'm aware that I'm asleep.
And
I'm aware
and I am too.
Everything is a dream.
Right.
But this is called lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming.
Your business, Mandy.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Right.
I'm learning so much today.
Not this REM shit.
Maybe that's what you're doing is like, and then you can kind of be like, and then you're like, oh, I can kind of control this.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think I have special powers. That's exactly it. I'm lucid dreaming. I know I'm laying in bed. I know I'm in my house. I know the alarm is about to go off, but I don't want to open my eyes to see what time it is. So rather than open my eyes and become fully awake, I dream that it's 3 hours earlier. That's basically
what time is this normally at? Like, what time is your alarm?
Oh yeah. And it will be like, if it's like right before the alarm goes off. My brain knows when the alarm's going off and I wake up.
Is it like really early in the morning? Like, do you get up really early or like, is it like,
more than
he doesn't look at that hair. There's no way he gets up early.
It's funny. The only days I wake up at 6:30 are the days I go skateboarding with my 7 a.m. skateboard crew, which is like high school.
I feel like that's an oxymoron of a 7 a.m. skateboard crew.
We got to get there before Costco opens and then all the cars come and then it's day. We have to get there before the cars. And everyone I skate with has a day job. They're firemen and stuff. So we have to do it in the morning.
Wow, what a brag.
Firemen. I know firemen. My nephew's a fireman. My brother-in-law's a fireman. How many firemen do you guys know? Karen's father, fireman.
And about 100 other people in my family.
Really?
I think I had a nephew once who wanted to be a fireman. There you go.
And that's it? Mm-hmm. Some total... Like half of one,
yep.
Basically?
I mean, I wouldn't even give it one. It's none of them. None of them.
My nephew has freshly become a fireman.
Congratulations.
Yeah, he has the outfit and everything.
I'm going to trump you all in being boring by saying my uncle Martin teaches at the fire college in San Francisco. So if you become a fireman in San Francisco, my Uncle Martin teaches you like the book part.
Oh, that's wow. Cool.
Does he like it?
Thanks. I wanted to kind of blow your guys' mind. It feels like I did.
Does
he like it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe he enjoys doing it.
He's been doing it a while. So I think he does. He's been doing it a long time.
I've never heard of such a thing as a fire college because recently I was thinking it would be very important and helpful if there was some kind of a police college.
I can't believe that you guys keep calling it police school and police college when the police academy films the entire film series.
There's six or seven
taught
of
us
them.
All that.
I 100% thought it was called police school.
I mean, Mandy, Bobcat Goldthwait is in your book. And but you know,
I thought that they made the name better, that they didn't actually use the real name.
I believe it was number three, Citizens on Patrol. That's the one that spoke to me the most as a skateboarder, because I realized as a teenage skateboarder, I could help solve crime by launching a sweet method over the hood of a car.
This feels like a TV show you pitched.
No, it was Tony Hawk and the entire Bones Brigade were in Police Academy 3. Tony Hawk is 6'4" or 6'5", and he was the stunt person for David Spade, who I believe is 4, you know, 5. Well, I don't want to offend the man. He's in his mid-5. He's in the mid-5 range.
He'd admit he's petite.
He's a petite.
He's got jokes about it.
Yeah. He would call himself dainty, even.
I would say that you just did the most perfect segue into talking about Mandy's book.
I know.
And then we went back to police.
I know.
Again.
I know.
But we should talk about it, though, because it is beautiful. I mean, it is a gorgeous book, but it's also, Stephen talked about it on our staff meeting this morning.
Oh, it's nice.
It's basically, you know, Mandy being a comedy show, live show producer in Los Angeles and around the globe, but also a photographer, began to take a series of photos at the shows for comics that then most comics began to use all the time and became almost like a, it was like the picture, the sepia tone kind of, you know, basically headshot.
Yeah.
The Mandy Johnson headshot, essentially, that became so well known throughout the biz. Mandy, yeah. Mandy, let me ask you.
Yes, Karen.
How did you get the idea that you were like, I'll give comics basically free headshots?
I mean, it truly didn't start off as that. And it didn't even start off to be a book. It started off as a need to show people, audience members and comedians who had done the show and create SEO and drive traffic to the website. And Joel was like, it basically was our version of like a comedy club wall, where comedians sign headshots and then they put them up in frames and they sit there forever and gather gross dust.
Yeah. But it's my favorite thing. When I go to a comedy club, it is to look at the wall and see comics that have moved on and become head writers of TV shows or just went off into obscurity. I always look at the comedy club wall in any club. And this book is
absolutely
a lot of these photos in this book I do recognize from the comics using these photos as their headshots. You were giving away free headshots.
Free headshots.
I mean, it was definitely like, and when we started in 2010, when we very, very first started, we couldn't afford to pay. And then we got a sponsor about 6 or 7 months in. And so then we were able to pay everyone consistently, which was something that was always important to me and Joel. But in the meantime, I was like, well, all of you need photos. So here are some photos for you. I can't pay you, but here are some, you all need photos. I've looked online. You do not have them. Here are some photos.
Yeah. And well, because most people tried to get the like $199 set when they were 27.
Yeah.
And then just never do it again. That's definitely what I did. It was just like, get what you get when you, you know, when you absolutely have to and then never look back.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of comics I know that are doing well that still have 15-year-old headshots where of a hairline of the past.
I photograph a lot of comedians' portraits that they'll use for headshots. And a lot of times they'll come in and be like, I haven't done this in like a decade. I'm like, sure, that makes sense. And then they'll tell me, I hate this. And I'm like, you know, if you're successful, this is a thing that you're going to have to do a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's awkward. Do you direct while you're taking photo? Like, give me, okay, act like
I mean, a lot of times, because I think comedians will come to me because we know each other. And so
we can
kind of chat and hang out while I take photos. And so eventually they just relax.
Yeah.
And, you know, sure, there's like, it's digital now. So there's like 300 photos of them talking that are completely unusable. But
right.
Then there's like, you know, 150 that are great of them having a moment or like in between or, you know, posing more naturally. But it just kind of eventually they get comfortable and they relax into themselves more.
Yeah.
And then they're just more natural as a whole. But the first time
digital,
I mean, it makes such a huge difference.
It's so much easier. I think of back when I was snowboarding a lot, there'd be three or four photographers taking pictures of everyone. And you could tell who wasn't worried about money because it was in the film days. They'd be just snapping sequence after sequence. And other folks were like, well, I don't want to burn a bunch of film here. Like people used to have to worry about the expense of developing and then finding out that you wasted a bunch of shots.
It was cheaper to purchase and develop film back then.
Yeah.
But it still was an actual cost versus just like a one-time cost of a memory card, you know?
Right.
And so
I guess that's the way to look
now at it. When I shoot film, I never felt like that when I shot film, but now when I shoot film, I feel like that because it's so challenging and like you have to I send my film out to labs that don't exist that aren't in Los Angeles to get developed. Cause the one in Los Angeles that does like medium format is very expensive.
Deluxe?
Icon?
I just wanted to guess a photo lab and see if I could get it right.
Icon is the only one that I know that does medium form. Like there's a lot of great 35 millimeter places, but But so I find still... myself kind of like being like, is this worth shooting film for?
Right. Did you ever like mess with it, like the actual emulsion process in the in a dark room and with chemicals?
I never processed color film, but I grew up is a strong word, I guess. But from like high school, middle school, I processed my own form, black and white film for ages. I processed 35 medium format in college. I processed my own 4x5 film, which is how the photos in the book are shot. They're all shot on a 4x5 camera.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was kind of my cheat to like get around my nervousness for shooting them, especially early on. I was like, look at this really cool camera. Don't you want to be photographed with this cool ancient camera?
Feel like Abraham Lincoln. I'll put a blanket over my head.
It is pretty amazing, though, when you look at this book, and you definitely should, and get Mandy's book, because it is an I had no idea how many huge people you got on those on that show and it for that book. Like, as I flipped through it, I was just like, oh my God, there's legit big stars in this book. It's really cool.
Cool because it is, I feel like I haven't gone all the way through it, but it seems like it's like specifically about the independent comedy scene in the exact time that I like, just starting with, how far back did you go? Is it pre-2000?
Well, I think it technically goes back to the 70s.
Oh, wow.
I think Andy Kindler talks about the 70s and the timeline. Hang on. It's dated 1989, I guess, is the oldest. But I think Kindler talks about a little bit before that. But I guess James Adomian clocked it where he said I was like born and grew up. Or he moved there in 89, and that was like the earliest interview specific year I had. But Kindler talks a lot about Kindler, Karen, Greg Barrett.
Oh, yeah.
Greg Barris. Yeah, they all talk a lot about Pardo, about the time that I wasn't in Los Angeles yet. So the time that I didn't spend in the independent scene, I moved here in 2004. And so I kind of came in right before UCB opened up and went to like house party shows and like that happened in garages and stuff. And like, you know, like saw Holy Fuck came and started doing stuff right before we started Super Serious Show. And the Comedy Bureau kind of came after us. And then Meltdown started happening right after we started Super Serious. And then it kind of, you know, I mean, Meltdown Weekly started happening. Jonah was doing it monthly, but, you know, so it kind of all culminated, I think, and really took off in like 2010, but in a way that we all knew it pre-pandemic, you know, where like tons of there's a lot of independent, like the independent comedy scene was very vibrant in Los Angeles, I feel like, and maybe it's most vibrant it's ever been. And, you know, in the city where like there were so many shows and so many ways to see comedy and so many places for comedians to get up comparatively. Yeah. I'm sure like people would argue that they still had a hard time finding sets and New York still had more sets as a whole or whatever.
Maybe back then. Yeah. Yeah. That was the brag about New York. We moved here around the same time. You pretty much listed the history of my being here.
But I got a lot of great historical context and things that I kind of knew from like Dana and Karen and that whole gang and like didn't know, you know, and things that I kind of got clarified and stuff along the way in the interviews, which was really interesting for me as somebody who loves comedy and who has produced it for so long and found independent comedy, of course, to be important, as is club comedy, but independent comedy to be important just to give people places and spaces to do stuff.
So. Yeah. I've always tried to do both, and I don't even separate the two anymore. I like that they're kind of just becoming the same thing.
That was the funny thing in the 90s, because I was here probably a decade before you guys, because I moved here in 94, and it absolutely was the dawn of club comedy versus what they called alternative comedy. And it was which is just what the era was like, just incredibly anti. So it was like you were supposed to pick a team or a side or a type. But I had started in clubs because that was essentially all there was, because I started in San Francisco with Greg Barrett and a lot of the people that are in this book, and who, and everyone migrated down to LA because clubs started closing up there. And, you know, being a club comic was basically, it was basically like you were just going to get in line to see if you could eventually get booked and move your way through this kind of pecking order. And then moving to LA, it was like everything broke open real wide. And it's like, you can go do a show with people who headline at the Improv, but it's down at a cafe in your own neighborhood, and you can get stage time. You can practice stuff. You can do kind of, you can find your voice before you get ready for this, the finalized, memorized, polished performance, which was so cool. It was just the opposite of how I started, because it was like my my nervousness when I started stand up was just like you had to be good already. Yeah. Even though, you know, you just started, you, my jokes were garbage upon garbage, but you just, you were in a club, so you kind of had to meet the standard, basically figure it out, do what you can. Whereas down here it just felt like, yeah, there was much more. That concept of experimental comedy, or like get on stage and see what's actually funny, before you take it to the clubs. Yeah. Where, because it's LA, so people are, it's tourists paying a bunch of money. They want a good show. They want consistent laughter. Yeah. So you can't, you know, I don't know. It was an interesting thing, and it was funny that it they tried to turn it into the, you know, they tried to turn it into like the Civil War, where it's, yeah, like pick your side, and you're supposed to hate people, and the club comics fucking hated alternative comics.
Yeah.
Like, it's not funny. It's like, okay, well, it's just, it was insane.
Yeah, it is.
Do you know something? I've never thought of this before this moment, but like, I remember Dana talking to me about like when he started his first independent show with Janine Garofalo. It was because the owner of the Improv came up to him when he was trying some new stuff out at like a weekly show, not a weekend show, but like a weekly show. I mean, they're still paying plenty of money for a weekly show, but he was like, these people aren't paying for your experiments. And Dana was like, I live here. Like, I need to work on material before I go on the road. And so he started an independent show at a bookstore with Janine for them to specifically work out material. But having the war between quote unquote alternative and club, where did the quote unquote club comics work out material?
Right.
I mean, that's just it.
I've never really thought about it, because now the worlds are so blended, or, you know, pre-pandemic, they were so blended that they could go to like independent shows, because independent audiences don't care if you're a quote unquote club comic, as long as you're not like, I don't know, I guess ending every joke with like, my dick's so big or something like that. I don't know.
Well, that's just, I think, but that was part of the argument was if like the time that you get on stage to try new stuff, it is in front of 300 people in like the main room, you know, the Comedy Store main room, that you are going to tend toward crowd pleasing material that might not be the best material. It might just be claptrappy, you know, shock value, whatever, that it's going to bend your ear toward crowd pleasing as opposed to what's funny. What I think's amazing about your story is Dana Gould. He was a headliner in San Francisco when I started. So I've seen Dana do 100 sets probably, and I've never seen him him trying new stuff was anybody else's perfect polished 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So the balls of whoever that motherfucker was, who was just like, yeah, people aren't paying to watch you work stuff out. It's like, I can't imagine Dana being like rough or even mediocre in any way. He is such a constant, like, that's just mind boggling. And it's the kind of thing where it's just like, that's, I think the concepts were too narrow. And I think that idea of just like, what if lots of other things were funny? And what if you could bring something polished that was weird to the stage, and then get people to laugh at that?
Right.
You know, God forbid you get these people's ear to change to what they're hearing. So it's not just like, you know, it's not just the same rhythm, the same concepts, the same topics all the time.
Right.
Yeah. And I think what really melded the worlds together was, I think it's been an interesting thing from the aughts to now, where Hollywood has right? Like famously, like so many of writers from The Simpsons were found at like Luna Lounge and stuff. And what, so Hollywood has been drawn to the independent comedians in the independent rooms and finding and scouting people through that. And then that, you know, Sarah Silverman and stuff has driven Hollywood material. And so then those people get famous on that level and then are able to go and do clubs more freely. And then it's like a cyclical thing that feeds itself so that, you know, Moshe and Natasha or something were in independent rooms only. But then as they get famous and rise in a Hollywood standard, then they're more acceptable at clubs because club owners are like, oh, you're famous, so you can draw an audience. And then they do club, you know, and it's a very funny, it's a very funny thing. Like famously, Kristen, I think, just did the improv for the first time, like within the past, like three years.
Yeah, that's.
And that's crazy to me that, you know, it's taken that
and
long.
I was surprised that there was comics I worked with when
comedy store. Not
oh, right.
Improv.
No. Yeah. I immediately just thought the Comedy Store because that's so many. That used to be a scary place that was hard to park and I didn't want to go there. And now all my friends are there and it's totally changed the environment. But when I would work in Austin, open for these, like Robert Hawkins was a guy that didn't seem like a road comic. He was really goofy and weird, but he lived in this city. And when I moved here and of course contacted him because I didn't know anyone really, I was so surprised to hear that I just go on the road. I don't really perform in town. Why do you live in Los Angeles?
Oh, that's crazy.
And I tried to convince him, and I did, to do UCB one night, to do the Comedy Death Ray show, because I knew he'd do well, because he's a bizarre mind. And it seemed like he was kind of intimidated by the alternative scene. He's like, I don't think they'll accept me. So it's funny that both sides to this thing were thinking the same thing. They're not going to accept me as a mainstream comic, and then vice versa. The working road comics are like.
Yeah, meanwhile, that audience couldn't
exactly.
Care. That audience is like, you were funny,
or
the you're
audience
not funny.
Never has differentiated.
And that is like the real like line. I think I've watched it happen so many times in like Hot Tub, where it's a famous comedian. They're working out stuff. And the audience is like, no, that's not funny. And they're like, okay, thank you so much for that honest feedback.
Yeah. There is a bit of that. I almost feel like in this city, people can smell when you're doing your material. I think it's also like
we've definitely trained a specific audience that enjoys the process, which I think is really cool. I don't think that every audience is like that. They enjoy watching comedians work out stuff and being part of it in that way. And I think also, I know that that's challenging sometimes when comedians want to just like go and do a set that's easy for them and like go and do stuff that they know is going to be good, or they want to get a good tape or whatnot. But I think it's cool that the audiences in Los Angeles want to like watch the process, because it's not something, I mean, something that I've always loved, but it's not something that every audience wants, which I think is
unique. Well, I think that energy of the difference between when you're watching somebody kind of like, you know, shoot for the moon as they're doing their stuff, where it's almost like they're talking over the audience and out into some like the camera of life of like, here's the 15 minutes that's gonna, you know, make or break me, as opposed to a person that's kind of on stage. And it's stylistic too, because I think that it blended into the style of, it seems like this is off the top of your head, or it seems like, or people that got smart about like, don't save the crowd work for, you know, like you can walk on stage and immediately do crowd work. It's actually a very bold move and it makes the audience go, oh shit, they really are like it. And I think that difference is there are people who are like, it's the uprising of the comedy nerd, because there are people who are like, just like, I like to laugh, and they're sitting there and it's like, that's great. And they'll never go, oh, that's, I've seen this bit before, or this is a very common trope.
Yeah.
There are people who are just like, I'm here to have fun and I don't care, you know, I don't care what happens. But people who follow comedy, you walk on stage and you get a certain tone in your voice and they immediately are like, mm-mm. You know what I mean? So the expectation is, I want to see you walk the tightrope a little bit and earn that, badge of bravery and improvisation. Yeah. You know, it's like then the UCB-ness of it all started blending together yeah. where it's like you could do improv, you could do stand up, you could do both. You have all, you can flex all these different ways. Then that makes me think of there's so many shows I've been to where people who clearly are from improv get up to do sets and they fucking eat it so royally because they're doing a character. They're doing a character of a comedian.
Right.
So it's all very kind of insincere and like 3 feet away. And I feel like the true comedy fan really wants to feel like your heart rate. You know what I mean? Yeah. They want to know you're right there. Delivering, you know, fresh, new, I just feel like that's, maybe that's just my expectation. It's like,
no, I think you're
they
right.
want you to give them something new and risky. Like they want you to risk it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I always tell a lot of times when we have like British comedians, you know, who come over and do Hot Temper Super Serious Show, they'll kind of ask about the audience and like ask how it's different and stuff. And the thing I always tell people, and lots of the times I'm like, I wish somebody had told me this more earlier in America. And it's like such a very simple thing. I was like, in these rooms, you just need to talk to the audience and not at yes. them. Like, and it's, I know it's like a mind fuck of a thing because you're like, I am talking to them, but you're like, no, but you're talking to that back yeah. wall. You're talking to that invisible camera. You're too presentational sometimes, you know, and they just want you to talk to them. They're there. They're part of the show. They're an integral part of your experience as a comedian and the experience of the show as a whole. And that is the main difference, I think, between a big club room and a big independent room is they just want to be talked
yeah.
to them.
Yeah. Versus and you can them. Actually, like I taught myself a couple tricks, which is, definitely make a joke about one of the last jokes the comic before you
yeah,
did.
Yeah, I do it all the time.
Right? You got to do that because then that's saying I've also been in the audience along with you this yeah. whole time. I know what's going on. And then something about while you're doing your set, which clearly is, I mean, that was also the pain of being a guitar comic. There's no way to pretend you're improvising. There's no way to pretend you're not doing a polished thing. And also as you're doing it, you're just stuck inside it. You can't bail. You can't do anything else. You're just like, now here's my 3 minute presentation or whatever. It's so painful.
It's funny. Whenever you say guitar comic, I know you as a regular stand up. And then I also know you as a musician. So sometimes I would see you do stand up and also play songs. But when I hear guitar comic, I think of parody, like goofy songs
I know.
That rhyme and they're about farting and I'm in Tulsa and the guy has a cowboy hat. I'd like it if you didn't just call yourself a guitar comic. That was well, that's
if
not
you
what
are
you, I
on
guess,
a comedy show. If you're on a comedy show and you walk out wearing a guitar,
yeah, yeah.
The audience is like eh. The audience in rooms like this. I think if it was you know, like at the improv, it's a little show. It's like, "Oh, it's exciting." It would blow my mind how well those weird little songs would do at a place like the improv, because I would be like, oh, I don't think these, you know, these tourists aren't going to like it. And it's like these days, and that was, you know, whatever, mid 2000s, everybody has comedy chops these days. Yeah. Everybody knows comedy. It's around so much. It's become so kind of ubiquitous in so many different ways that everybody has a little bit of good taste. Obviously, there's like, oh, I like this type of comic or that. But ultimately, I think so many more people these days appreciate like a original joke or a well thought out, you know, well planned joke. Like, it's just funny how I feel like I've starting in 1990, you know, and then performing in the 2000s, I feel like the audience has evolved for yeah. sure.
Well, I think podcasts did a lot of that. I mean, podcasts brought comedians into the space of the fans in the most personal yeah. way, where they listen to them. I mean, like I listen to podcasts the most when we go on like road trips and we drive a lot. And it's like, oh, I've listened to like 8 hours of The Dollop or something. And so I just feel like I've been hanging out with Dave and Gareth and like they are my friends, but it feels more personal to me. Like they've been with me on this road trip, which they yes. have not been. They have like, I know them and we're friends, but they have not been with me on this road Correct. Trip. And so I can imagine for like somebody who doesn't know comedians, that that feeling would be the same. And I think that then that evolved the audiences of stand up in a very cool yeah. way, where they became more fandom definitely towards the podcast that they love, but they also had a different relationship with comedy and comedians yeah. and maybe understood them more and understood yeah. where their comedy comes from more and understood who they are as people more, which is something that non-common, like non-stage comedians, but who exist in comedy like myself, were probably the only people who understood that balance and that lifestyle and that world, you know, pre-podcasts. So it's, I think it's been a cool
thing. Last few years for me, the audiences, it's people that kind of know me already, and it's become, at first I was taken aback by it, and now it's so comforting to know that I'm like safe in front of these sweet people that listen to podcasts. It's the best.
It's really nice. You don't have to be like, let me tell you a little something about myself.
Yeah.
My favorite phrase in the world, let me tell you a little something about myself.
Yeah. I know what you're thinking.
Yeah. Always followed up with just nothing personal and a joke. But yeah, it is the other funny thing is, and Chris, I think I know you witnessed this happen when April and I did that show at the Improv Lab. That was at the beginning of My Favorite Murder, and a bunch of some of our listeners would come to that.
Yeah.
But they were podcast listeners, so they were super quiet. Like they wouldn't even, it was hilarious the first couple of shows where I would just be like, yeah, you guys, this is a different thing. You're not sitting in your car driving to work.
Yeah, yeah. You're not going to get in trouble at your desk if you laugh out loud. But I've gotten used to it. I can tell, I just pay more attention visually to the look on people's faces. And I'm okay with it not being uproarious laughter, actually.
Yeah.
It's a lot of times when a crowd was that hot and they're laughing at everything, I'm like, I don't believe you. You're all just drunk and trying to be entertained.
I had to do, what was that? That VH1 stand-up show.
Oh.
Rosie O'Donnell hosted it first. Do you remember? You know what I'm talking about, right? Stand-up. I believe.
I know what you're talking about. I remember when they shot a stand-up show at the Heist House, but I didn't know it was.
It was, and it went on for years. And the audiences knew they were on a TV show. It was like, and it was produced for TV and whatever. Yeah. I got booked on it, and I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. I walked out and I went into the setup of my first joke, and at the end of the first sentence, the audience burst out laughing so loud that I was like, whoa. And I kind of got shook. I was like, I don't know what's going on. And the audience was just laughing at pauses because they knew they were on TV.
Yeah.
And it was one of the worst sets. And I've almost strictly done terrible television sets. early days.
By choice. Yeah.
But that one was mind blowing because I was just like, oh, this isn't about my creative mind or these wonderful concepts I'm about to present you. They're just like, we live in LA, we're actors, we're the audience, we're gonna fucking give you audience. So it's just like, nonsensically. It was upsetting.
They reposted my old Premium Blend, which was 2003, and those audiences.
That's what it was, right? Premium Blend?
It was like a casting service or something. And I accidentally mentioned that New York. I just said New York, and the whole crowd started screaming and hooting. And I literally plugged my ears and said, no, I didn't. Oh, no, my ears. I literally plugged my ears and said my ears because I did not expect that to happen. It threw me off so much. And luckily they edited it.
I think the set I did, if it ended up on the air, which I don't know if it did, but if it did, it was 2 minutes long.
Yeah.
Cut it down to nothing because I just kept like flinching at the audience's response.
Maybe that's how it's going to be now. In coming months, people are going to be so excited to see comedy. I'm actually very much looking forward to it, but I wonder if the audiences will be rusty, just like the comedians.
I mean, I think that they'll be so excited.
Yeah.
But it'll still take a really long time before we're going to have full rooms again, I think.
Yeah.
The audiences will be excited. They'll also be shit-faced drunk.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably right.
It's going to be an interesting walk back, I think, into that space and into like them consuming comedy, not from their living rooms again, you know, and not from, because like they can mute themselves and they can talk and do things. And I mean, I think that they'll all be very excited to come back. And I truly can't wait to pack the virtual shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that like Super Serious Shows audiences have always kind of been like that, where they're like, we call them theatrical audiences.
Yeah.
Where they would clap and they'd be like, this is funny, I'm quiet now.
Yeah.
This is funny. I'm quiet now. And so like there's none of the rolling into the things, you know? They want to like listen so intently and make sure they don't miss anything. God, they're too polite.
Maybe it's something about the acoustics of that stage or so, because I feel like every show
it doesn't happen at a hot tub.
I always feel that experience, whenever I'm there.
I mean, it's an interesting thing. And so I think it's so polite when audiences do that, and they're trying to be differential. They're trying to give what they believe is the right respect to the comedians.
Right.
And what they don't know is like, we just want you to laugh. Like, that's like, laugh or don't laugh. Like, we judge everything by your laughter or not your laughter. Like, you know, it is like the barometer that this show lives and dies by.
I do like the fact that audiences have developed that understanding about like being quiet and not talking. And you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That honestly, starting in clubs in 1990, you were just fighting drink noises, just full on conversational chatter at tables. I mean, like
nothing,
you were fighting so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was rough. If you were the opener or, you know what I mean? Like lowered, or if it was like a showcase night, it was just a battle.
Yeah.
So the fact that it has slowly developed into this kind of thing where like the people who are sitting there didn't get free tickets off the radio. They're sitting there because they want to be there and they know people on the show.
Yeah. When someone heckles now, I'm like, did you just step off a time machine? How even, and the audience too, they're like, oh my God, a heckler. They want to look at him.
I'm also so confused constantly. And I've had it where I've had a few friends who have done this, and I found it really hard, even as somebody who works in comedy, to have this conversation with them where I'm like, they're a positive heckler. They're like, it's like, and I'm like, they don't need that. They're fine.
Yeah.
Like laugh. Like all they want is like, don't tell them they're, unless they ask for like a rhetorical yes or something. Yeah. Why are you, they don't need your encouragement.
Yeah. Just the audience member that's like, uh-huh. Oh yeah.
Or like, I'm with you. You're doing great. I'm like, no, I know you think you're doing such a nice thing, but please stop positively heckling them.
It's really hard.
No, I don't think they're doing a nice thing. I think they're doing a narcissistic actory thing or a kooky, like either they're on something.
Yeah. It's usually like, drunk.
That's LA stuff of making it about you.
Yeah,
where
it's
just like, I will always, always get women who are drunk who are like, wow! Like, cause I'll say something that they find so, you know, like, I can't believe she said it or whatever, where it's just like, okay, but this isn't about you and your college experience. Like, it's hilarious to me. And it also makes me, I am always very mean to those people because it's just like, just don't do it. Yeah, and also, this is my job as a comic. Like, you've now put a target on your forehead. It doesn't matter how much you love me, because I have to now. If I'm ever going to get on YouTube as comedian who destroys heckler.
Oh, God. Fingers crossed.
I'm going to have to attempt to destroy you.
I one day hope to own a heckler.
Oh,
own them. That's the next level. You can destroy.
I'm so sorry. Are you discussing like owning a human being?
That's judging by what all these YouTube videos I've seen, a lot of comedian owns heckler. And so I guess then they come live at your house and
I do like this couch. It's really comfy.
Yeah. They become your pool boy. Well? Kind of like Hardcastle and McCormick, a show that I shouldn't have referenced.
I have had to send like Kurt out before and been like, hey, we have a positive heckler in the crowd, so I need you to do a thing where you tell everyone not to heckle, not to video, like the things. But also explain that like positive heckling is bad too. Okay, thanks, bye.
Yeah,
good luck, Kurt.
This weekend, I'm doing an outdoor jazz festival, and I feel so rusty. But it's outdoor. I'm actually looking forward to see if there is a band on stage. I'm going to sit in with them and do mouth horn. I'm very excited about that.
Where is this? Where is this?
In San Diego.
Oh.
And
is it daytime?
I think it's early evening, yeah, but I was told it's outdoor. I will be nowhere near anyone, just go directly onto a stage, and so I agreed to do it, and I'm kind of looking forward to it just because I'm so excited to be doing this again. Sure. But I really want to sit in with an actual brass band and like, it's gonna be great.
I mean, it's a good mouth horn. Infamous.
It is the opposite of famous. It's infamous.
Mandy, do you have any the best thing that you ever saw happen at a show, or your favorite moment or something along those lines, having watched 10,000 hours of stand-up comedy? Like any of those kind of beautiful live show moments that can only happen at live shows?
I think that the ones that are always in my memory are the ones that only happen that one time. And it could be Rory doing an all improvised set. It could be a crowd work moment with Andy Peters where somebody breaks a glass and then it like leads him onto a weird train where he's like interviewing the person and then like has bits about their life. But it could also be like Dimitri Martin saying a new one-liner for the first time and seeing it doesn't work and then commenting on the audience reaction to it. Like all of that stuff that is like irreplaceable and like you can't repeat it.
Yeah.
Right. Is so precious, I think, to me in comedy. That's the thing that I think I realized early on as somebody who consumed comedy. And then when I started producing it, I think when you think back to your favorite memories, it's like, and it's like even like sometimes, Karen, it's like the little in-betweens you used to have in your songs, you know, like those weren't rehearsed and those were really off the cuff. And like you kind of commenting on the audience or like talking about the room or the space or like, you know, a drunk woman coming up to stage at South by Southwest to talk to Baron about like something that upset her, you know, with security closing in because we weren't sure exactly what she was going to do. But it's all those like moments that won't ever happen again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love it when I love it when an audience recognizes it as a once in a lifetime moment and then they clap. They recognize it. Well, we've been laughing. Let's clap for that because that was a moment in time. I love that moment where they decide to clap instead of because they're acknowledging that it was, an artistic moment just happened. The best feeling. I miss it.
When you like, you talk to people, like I remember the first like High Plains that we went to, like Reggie had a big, you know, closing set that was very fun, but it's also the highest I've ever seen Reggie ever, like ever. And I talk to Kurt about it all the time because I'm like, do you remember that one set when Reggie was like, he was like so high, you know? And so like, you can then have that moment with that person or those people that were with you that nobody else will really ever be able to experience because they weren't there. And it's, you can explain it to them and you can tell them and they can kind of conceptually understand it, especially if they're in comedy a lot. But it's something that's just, it's just so special when it happens and it's just there and it's live. And I think that that's what a lot of times when you film comedy and you cut a 10-minute set down to 2 minutes or a 7-minute set down to 2 minutes for a TV show, and then the people who watch are like, oh, this is so like stunted and like stiff. Yeah. It's like, cause that's not their real set. That's not their real thing. You know, it's like, it's inauthentic to the comedian. It's not a good representation of who they are on stage. And, and you know, it's like the best version of it that's been recorded is like Jimmy Pardo's Crowdwork album, which I don't know if you've ever, I could like listen to that over and over and over again. It's like, I don't even think he meant like he was recording an album, but he just did crowd work for an hour and it was so funny.
Oh yeah. He's,
and it was just
unbelievable,
but it was just like perfect in the way of capturing that energy that's so hard to capture on film and in an album and in a way that feels real and not staged, you know?
Right.
It just made me think that I if I had to pick someone for that, most of the time it's been memories of watching Andy Kindler, because when Andy starts eating it, like there's a dynamic Andy brings out where the comedians can't stop laughing because the audience is not laughing and Andy is reading off his index cards and then getting mad and then getting really funny, but he loses the audience, he gets them back, he loses them again, like the
journey,
the journey and the dynamism of his performances have always been so amazing. That to me, it's those comics that are like, I think he's one of those people that defies all of that. He's a club comic, he's an alternative comic, he can do everything, because every time he's on stage, he's absolutely like, "Well, Shmoopy, why didn't you like that joke?" You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, he's constantly confronting the audience about what they are or are not doing. It's just, yeah.
Yeah,
I miss live performing so much.
He is a comic. He acknowledges every moment as it's happening.
Every moment.
And he's the only person where I'm like watching him and I'm thinking, God, he's a genius. While simultaneously, the audience is a little confused. There's the way he deals with that. It's my favorite. He is a comic.
He gives the audience the opportunity to judge and dismiss him. And it's like he's like, because some of his jokes are incredibly corny, but they're usually the kind of current event ones. Like, then he just starts riffing through those cards. It is just like, it's that kind of thing where you're watching the audience think they're the expert when actually the expert is in charge. Like, the expert is doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
It's just,
I remember in like late Obama years, he would do Hot Tub, and the audience at Hot Tub is very progressive. I would say that they were, you know, as a whole, Bernie supporters.
Yeah.
If you had to, like, you know, paint them with one brush. But so he would say something positive about Obama and the audience would be like, "No, we don't." "No, he's not progressive enough for us." And it would kind of catch Andy off guard, because he'd be like, "Oh, this is going to be a thing that's going to be fine." And then it wouldn't. And watching him recoup from that while commenting on recouping from that, while commenting on how we thought it was safe, while commenting on how we thought it was still progressive, was such a very funny, like, loop of information.
Yeah.
And then it would eventually break the audience, you know?
Yeah.
And like, watching that moment when the audience finally gets on board with it is so perfect.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Stacking comment commenting on the comment on the comment. It's the best. Until they're finally like, "Okay, you got us. Now we know. Now we understand. We've just learned something. Thank you."
It is like kind of like taming a wild horse. I remember the very first, I think when we started Hot Tub, Kurt and Kristen were there for like the first year and a half, like straight, and that has never ever happened again. And then the very first guest host we had was Sean Patton, and he had to, like, it was like breaking a horse. He had to, like, go into the audience. He had to work so hard. And when he finally broke them and got them on board, because they were just mad that Kurt and Kristen weren't there, right? They were like, "How dare you?
Not this isn't my favorite horsey."
Yeah. But when he finally broke them, then he started the show. And it was such a magical thing to watch a comedian be like, no, "You're going to get on board with me. We're going to have fun tonight. I don't care what it costs. I will stand up here and say brown butter baby until I'm blue in the face."
That's the best. It's so funny that I thought before this that you had done the podcast with Joel, but I just, because I love going to the airport. One time I was picking up Nate, and Nate Craig had flown with you or something, or ran into you at the airport. And I did pick you up. I did drive you home, but we just weren't recording.
We weren't recording.
No. It was just me.
And I wasn't there.
And you weren't there. Yeah. All these little.
I definitely do not remember being in a car from the airport with Karen.
Yeah. It was just me. But in my mind, I was like, "Oh, yeah. I remember vividly you getting."
We all used to live on the same side of town. You moved.
But. Yeah, I did. I moved to the old Echo Park area. But yeah, I am no longer near that airport, and I don't miss it. Karen and I, neither of us miss the airport.
We oddly. Really don't miss driving to Los Angeles International Airport.
All the times.
A lot of where you guys were taking people, right? For the ride.
Oh, yeah. You can't fly out of Burbank usually unless you are a millionaire.
Yeah.
Quickly. The tickets are so much more.
They're so much more. Yeah. So much more. Mandy, do you have anything to plug? Anything?
Yeah.
Anything?
Besides the book, I do want to plug the Airbnb I'm at. I'm staying, and I know listeners, you can't see this, but I'm staying this very beautiful Airbnb that is Abby Launders, that is Moon Ridge Cottage on Airbnb. It's up in Big Bear, and Ooh. It's beautiful. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, and it is lovely, and it's wow. very cozy and comfortable. And I just think that anybody who's up in this area should stay here.
I'll stay yes. there, Moon Ridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she is a dear friend of mine, but it's also the first Airbnb I've ever stayed in where I'm like, oh, I kind of feel at home.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, nice.
You know, sometimes they have those uncomfortable couches or like
yeah.
the furniture is just kind of weird. You know what I mean? It's just yeah. like not yeah. quite right. This one, I actually like, I'm like, oh, this feels like I would live here.
Yeah.
I love that you're plugging an Airbnb.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be a producer.
Where
and I want to plug my book.
Yeah, Super where do you? Where do people get the book?
Anywhere books are sold. Super Serious: An Oral History of Independent Stand-Up Comedy in Los Angeles. And we're still doing Hot Tub Home Edition, which you can find us on YouTube. Cool. And the easiest way is to go to our Instagram, Twitter, and just click on the link tree, and it'll take you right to the place to watch us. And that's every Monday night at 8 p.m. Pacific.
That's terrific. And you can see awesome. Me doing mouth horn at a series of outdoor jazz festivals. Just kidding. This one.
Are you going to plug the one you're upcomer?
This will be, it'll be past. It's tomorrow, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about something from the past, a classic podcast mistake.
You know what, Chris? When we come back to live shows, I'll book you, but just for mouth horn.
Oh, a challenge accepted. Thank you.
You could be, Chris could be the opening act, mouth horn behind a mask.
Oh, yeah.
And you just kind of set that tone. Set
I hope you guys like Mangione.
But really muted.
Yeah, yeah.
Mandy, thank you so much for being here with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, thank you so
you
much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I thought you'd been on before. My memories get crossed.
You know, it's love. I've done more podcasts than ever in my whole life, and they've been all nerve-wracking and terrifying, but also very fun because I'm just talking to friends.
Yeah, yeah, it's just a hangout.
Yeah.
That's all.
Let's pretend we were just at a party.
Yeah. Karen, when parties come back, I am still going to come and cook for yours.
Oh, please, good.
And yes. I'm coming.
Because we made that plan.
Yes, we did.
In February.
February of 2019.
Yeah.
No, of 2020.
Did we do it like directly before?
Yeah, I remember I came over, I made that tomato galette.
Yo,
and
yeah.
we had dinner, and yes. you were like, I'm going to do monthly parties. And I yep. was like, I want to cook for them. And then like, and you were like, great, we'll plan one for March. And then like 2 weeks later, we were like, I guess that's
I didn't
never
realize
happening.
That was like, I didn't realize that was in February. That's hilarious.
Oh, what a year.
Then I was just like, see you later. I won't be answering your texts
I was
for
like,
the
do
next
you have
year.
Enough food? I know you have all those daily harvests.
We can just blend up a couple daily harvests and give those out.
I was like, do you have enough food to eat, Karen? It's just me checking all my friends. Are you going to starve to death? Thanks for having
Never.
Us.
Thank you, Mandy.
Absolutely. Great to see you. Great to talk to you.
You've been listening to Do You Need a Ride? DYN.
AR.
Hear that horn? Oh, boy.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. That's nice.
That's good.
That's good.
Are you leaving? Are you on your way back home? Either way, we want to be there. Doesn't matter how much baggage you claim, give us a time and date, terminal and gate. We wanna send you off in style, we wanna welcome you back home. Tell us all about it, were you scared or was it fine?
Mouth horn.
with Karen and Chris.